So the next, in chapter 9, the next point given by Srila Rupa Goswami is reciting notable prayers. According to great learned scholars, the whole Bhagavad Gita contains many authorized prayers, especially in the 11th chapter, where Arjuna prays to the universal form of the Lord. Similarly, in the Gautamiya Tantra, all the verses are called prayers. Again, in Srimad Bhagavatam, there are hundreds of prayers to the Lord. So a devotee should select some of these prayers for his recitation. In Skanda Purana, the glories of these prayers are stated as follows. Devotees whose tongues are decorated always with prayers to Lord Krishna are always given respect even by the great saintly persons and sages, and such devotees are actually worshipable by the demigods. Those who are less intelligent want to worship different demigods for some material gains rather than worship Krishna. But here it is stated that a devotee who is always engaged in offering prayers to the Lord is worshipable even by the demigods themselves. The pure devotees have nothing to ask from any demigod. Rather, the demigods are anxious to offer prayers to the pure devotees. In the Nrisimha Purana, it is stated, any person who comes before the deity of Lord Krishna and begins to chant different prayers is immediately relieved from all the reactions of sinful activities and becomes eligible, without any doubt, to enter into the Vaikuntha Loka. So reciting notable prayers, so this means prayers that are written by someone else, they're from the scriptures, written by the acharyas. These are the notable prayers. So just by chanting them, then the Lord becomes very pleased. Because the whole principle is that we're following in the footsteps of the devotees. When we serve the Lord, we're serving behind some other devotee. So they have a particular mood, they have their prayers that they're offering to the Lord. So now if we offer prayers to the Lord, then that principle of following that mood or following the footsteps of the other devotees is then accomplished. And so that pleases the Lord very much. We must also offer our own prayers, you know, from our own heart, but this was discussed in the previous point, the submission. But this is specifically offering prayers written by others. So that is very much appreciated by the Lord. Because those prayers then are the ecstatic mood of the pure devotees in their worship of the Lord. So their worship is perfect. These are, you know, people who are ahead of us, right? Because they were already written before we came. So then, being before us, we're following behind them. So this is the essential principle of devotional life, is one is associating with the devotees and trying to learn from them how to serve the Lord. And as we advance and we more and more start to gain their mood, gain their understanding, and want to follow behind them in their service, so we can serve the Lord in that same flavor, assisting in that same flavor. So this principle is then done by chanting these notable prayers. So even someone who doesn't understand this principle, they just know that it pleases the Lord, then that is a start. Then why it pleases the Lord? One is we're chanting the Lord's name and glories, so that we understand. But essential point is that it's offering prayers of those who are before us and then following in their footsteps. So dasanu dasanu das. This principle the Lord likes very much. So we see that even he likes to quote others. When he's taking the mood of the devotee, he'll always be quoting from Sridhar Swami and from others, from Gita Govinda and other prayers. He won't be making up his own prayers so much like that. He's always what others have written like that. That is what he likes to hear like that.
Well, yes. I was noticing in Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's parts where Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he hears glorification of himself. He just covers his ears. But then it's like when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya realizes who he is and composes those one and 108 shlokas and then 108 names, then there's no mention of him covering his ears. It's like he's happy to hear that authorized prayer.
It's because of in the pastime, the whole idea in the pastimes, then the Lord is reciprocating with the different devotees according to their affection for him. So, because they have affection for the Lord in that way, he'll reciprocate. Now, and then from that expands the pastime. It means there's a mood and then there's a pastime to go with it. So Lord Chaitanya is, when he's with the general devotees, then he's taking the mood of, he is the Lord's devotee. He is a devotee like everybody else is a devotee. So therefore he doesn't like to hear glorification of himself. Especially they're not just saying, oh, you're so nice and you have good qualities and you have so much devotion for Krishna. They're saying, you are Krishna, you are the Supreme Lord, you are this, you are like that. So that he does, because no devotee wants to hear that he's God. You know, he's a servant of God, okay, but he is, or the servant of the servant of God, but not that he is God. So therefore he'll cover his ears. But with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, then the relationship there, the rasa there, is that he is, means his, the relationship of Sarvabhauma with him is that here is God. So naturally, since that's the relationship, then he is reciprocating with that, so he doesn't mind. Because he's the, you know, in this way, he's the acharya, and like this. So So you'll get, so you see different things will go on. He'll be in, like, I think it's in Murari Gupta's house, or, and then they're discussing some things, and then he goes into that bhava of varaha. Then picks up the water pot in the corner and, you know, different things. So depending upon the devotee, but those are generally more private. It's between him and that devotee or those particular devotees. He'll taste all these different things. Because Lord Krishna means all other avatars are there. He's avatari, source of all the avatars. So Lord Chaitanya is Krishna, so he's avatari. So then in his pastimes, he'll have all these different devotees. So he'll have devotees from different pastimes. Murari Gupta is from Ramachandra pastimes. So I think he's Hanuman. So then these kind of aspects will be there. With them, that'll be there. But when he's in the general public, then he's a devotee, he's a sannyasi, you know, he's a Brahmin. So he has certain rules that he follows, the cultural rules, and that's as far as it goes. But when he's with specific devotees, with them privately, then he may manifest some very unique pastimes in their association. Does that make any sense? Anything else on this?
Does that mean in particular, Maharaj, he's very pleased as well with those glorifications and we should take it as a sign that if we chant these prayers specifically to him, composed by Sarvabhauma, there'll be some very nice spiritual
result. Yeah, he'll always. Because he has that mood. We also worship, I mean, every day, we worship Lord Chaitanya in that mood. Though we don't get into the prayers and all that, but the evening arti, the Gaur arti, is about when Lord Chaitanya is manifesting his Mahaprakash Leela. So for 21 hours, he manifested the mood that I am God. So that is what the evening artik is remembering. The Bogartik is remembering when he was taking his lunch, you know, at Mother Jashoda's house, when he's eating at Mother Jashoda's, and Rohanini is cooked, and Mother Jashoda and Radharani and the gopis are all there, and all that. So that's technically is the morning, but in the, how you say, the archan, the pancharatrik worship, the Raj Bhog is the main offering, because he's there with, he's kindly stays with us all day. But in the Nitya Leela, then he goes out in the morning, so he takes a big breakfast,
and then goes out, he takes a snack while he's out in the forest with the cowherd boys, and then he comes back and has dinner in the evening. But then, like when Gauranga Leela, then he'll eat at noontime. So the deity also, because that's the traditional thing, is that all the devas and everybody, they, you know, lunch is the main, that main meal. So we'll sing that for the lunch time. But it can be sung for any of the offerings, you know, except for, let's say, like the Mangal Arati or something, or just sweets. But otherwise, it's generally just sung for we sing it for the noon offering, because it has all those different preparations in it.
Because somebody said at midday, Krishna, when he's a little older, he's normally doing rendezvous with Radharani and the gopis at Radhakund, and there's a picnic, lunch, and all kinds of different leela.
Yeah, that's going on. Well, even when he's small, so it's up to when he starts taking out the calves. I think when he's five, he starts taking out the calves. Or like that. So up to that time, he may be at the house, but then generally he's out, you know, with his friends stealing butter and stuff like that. That's what they're, you know, doing for lunch. You know, it's like, but they go out and they have a snack and stuff like that. There may be times also when he's there in the house, because there are like there's in the Nectar Devotion that it mentions, and Balaram tells Krishna that today's your birthday, so don't go out. You know, so there'll be days also when he's there, and that, so that can be. So anything else on this notable prayers? Okay. So the next item is partaking of prasad. There is this specific statement in the Padma Purana. A person who honors the prasad and regularly eats it, not exactly in front of the deity, along with charinamrita, the water offered to the lotus feet of the Lord, which is mixed with seeds of the tulsi tree, immediately can achieve the results of pious activities, which are obtained through 10,000 performances of sacrificial rites. So, yeah. So the taking of prasad is so powerful. It's the, you know, more powerful than all these different kinds of yajnas and different things that one may perform in the Karmakanda section of the Vedas and all that, because it's devotional service. So when we say more than 10,000, where is this from? Padma Puran. So it's giving you an idea. We know it's even more than that. So unless the sacrifice is specifically service to Krishna, that's another thing. But if not, then it's so much more powerful. So people, they work so hard to elevate themselves and benefit themselves materially, but simply by honoring prasadam, then they get so much benefit. So they could simply just take the prasad and charinamrita. It also mentions not exactly, it says, and regularly eats it. So not exactly in front of the deity. So you don't want to be just in front, a little to the side, because one's a little shy, you know, so that's there. Especially when one's eating a full meal, then the deities would be closed. But if one's just taking a little something to the side, it's not that one has to hide and go somewhere else, but it's just not exactly in front, you know, a little to the side. Any questions on this?
Would
Yes.
Is there a difference in potency between taking Mahaprasad and ordinary prasad?
What's
I heard different opinions on that. It's all prasad and the effect is the same. Or is there more effect by taking Mahaprasad?
How do you define Mahaprasad?
Like the Rajpur, for example.
Oh, I see, off the deity's plate,
yeah.
Directly. What's on the deity's plate and what's, you've cooked a whole amount and then it's all offered, it's all prasadam, like that. So in that way there's no difference, it's all transcendental. But what's coming off the Lord's plate will have a tendency to make us think more of the Lord. By habit, then we're going to take prasad, we're going to sit down And then we'll worry about, yeah, I want this or not that, and, you know, give more of this, and, you know, so many different things. And we get very much involved in that routine. But the Mahaprasad, then we generally will stop and think, this is the Lord's and this and that. We may also not, you know. I mean, but it definitely, that gives more eagerness. Even if we don't remember the Lord, we're just thinking about we want to get something, you know. Like, you know, it's a fight over the sweets or something, but... It brings about more eagerness, more remembrance of the Lord. But technically, that's also called prasad. It depends how you put it. You can call prasad, and that's mahaprasad. Then there's mahaprasad. So that means is then after the Lord's eaten it, then that has been offered to the advanced Vaishnavas. Then after that, we take that. And that's considered, that has special potency. That is said to be. So, in some definitions I've heard probably explained like that, Mahaprasad. In others, it's the prasad on the Lord's plate and prasad in the pot is all prasad. And then when that off the Lord's plate, then it's been eaten by the devotee. That's called Mahaprasad. Okay. But in any case, what is happening is there's more remembrance, more of that, and so that's what makes us advance. But otherwise, Krishna's eaten all of it. It's not that he's not eaten. It's not that we've cooked something in a pot, we take some out and offer it to the deity, then we have to take that and put it back into this, the original cooking pot, then it becomes prasad. That's a more contemporary, idea from, you know, many not well-informed practitioners of the Vedic culture. But the Lord eats all of it, whatever we have decided, we have wanted him to take. Like that, because it's a matter of consciousness when we offer something. Let us say we've cooked, you know, a bunch of sweets. So now we can either take two of those sweets, put it on the Lord's plate. Those two are prasad, and everything else we cooked is prasad. Or, because that is the offering. Or it may be that we cook all the sweets, take two and put it on the sweets, but the rest of the sweets are for other offerings. So he'll only eat those two. He won't eat the rest of it. So that depends upon how we're thinking of it. If we think all this is for the Lord to eat now, he'll eat it all. And if we're thinking, no, it's only this, he'll eat just that. Because the point is he's accepting the devotion. It's the what we've cooked is the medium through which that devotion is offered. Like that. Yes, ma'am.
Two questions. One of them said that it was because the Lord was missing the Srila of Krishna, that it was Krishna.
Yeah. No, that's there. That is there. But from what I understand, all of it is, you know, all of it is. It's just that, as traditionally you would take the whole pot and put that in front of the deity. But many times, especially in our temples and all that, we generally tend to just make a nice little plate and like that. You know, it's a large offering. Large amount, you know, more, generally minimum what one person would eat, but generally a little bit more than that. And that, but otherwise, in many temples, they have special pots, and they just carry the pots straight in, and that's what is offered. So they have a much bigger boga offering, like in Jagannath. It takes them so much time to put the boga in. That's why they get late. You know, it's like you go for, you know, you know a particular Mahaprasad comes out at, you know, 5 o'clock, but you go there and they haven't even, you know, finished offering the morning, so they tell you to come back at 9 o'clock, you know, so, like that, because they're just behind. There's so much to move and they're just not as enthusiastic as they should be. You know, I think the last time it was all properly on time is when Bhaktivinoda Thakur was the magistrate there. So then he organized that they did it on time. They have enough manpower, just that I think they don't bother so much. Probably because it's like everybody has certain offerings that they get. And then with that, they maintain themselves. They're supposed to do... The tradition in Puri is that around the main temple there's tons of dharmshalas that were made, established by kings. And they're all for different locales, like the king of Manipur has his, someone, you know, king of Bengal has this one. So all over India they would all have dharmshalas there. Then there would be pandas who were assigned to these different dharmshalas. And the whole idea was that the panda, he would speak that language. And he would be given a share of the prasad. Then this is the system, is the person comes, stays, they're from Manipur, so they stay in the Manipur dharmshala for free. The panda who deals with the Manipuris, he has prasad, he gives them that for free. And he takes them around and tours and does this and that, and just takes care of them while they're there. Then, afterwards, naturally the person, according to their ability, they'll give some donation. But that donation is not necessary for maintaining that pujari, because he gets prasad, he has places to stay, and all this is taken care of. So the whole idea was to facilitate the pilgrims who come there, that they would be properly taken care of in that. But in time, then the dharmshalas have been, you know, they put up little walls and make little rooms and they rent them out, and so they get money from that, and they take the prasad and they sell all that, you know. I mean, there's a part that they do sell for the temple sells for, so anybody who comes who can get like that, or they want to get something. But they also, was these pandas were given. But that all doesn't quite work how it used to work. So, therefore, I think what happens is that their particular offering, it's like, well, if someone else is going to help them move it in and take them out, they want a share of that, so they don't want that, they'll do it themselves. So everything's slow. No, the deity never eats sin. See, this whole idea of pious and impious, it's all happening to our gross and subtle body. And, you know, it's just like it's happening to everything. The rain is falling on the stone. Doesn't bother the stone, doesn't bother the rain. But if we're out there, it bothers us because we're attached to the body. So whatever activity happens, then there's no, the material nature or the energy, the body itself, does not actually suffer or enjoy. It just experiences what is the situation that it's in. Like if the wind blows and it's cold and all that, the stone is wet and it's cold, but it doesn't care because it's not conscious. So because we're conscious of the body and we're attached to it, therefore we feel those things, we notice those things. So the body will go through those, the senses will notice, but the mind, because it's attached to certain things, then it enjoys and suffers. So that's only us, because we put a value to it. Krishna puts no value to it. It's just his material energy, and it's just the transformations of that energy. So he doesn't take our sin. He just removes it. Like that. Sometimes it's thought Krishna takes the sin. He doesn't take the sin. He just, by his will, it's removed. Like that. Because material nature works under his direction. So someone has done an activity. If it's done in relationship with him, then things go very smoothly. Like the animals work according to Krishna's direction. So everything goes nicely for them. But whatever is that they've done wrong as humans, then those things, then they'll get problem. But otherwise, the nature works accordingly, so it just functions. So the same way as the body, everything for the devotee, it just functions. But we are attached to it or not. So like the Uttamadhikari, acting as an Uttamadhikari, doesn't bother relating to the body. But when they come as Madhyamas, then they have to discriminate, so then they see what's good, bad, this, that. Because they also, the situation is there, what's good for preaching, what's bad for preaching. You know, and then when others are relating with them, they have to practice serving the Supreme Lord. So then what is favorable, what's unfavorable? Otherwise, they couldn't care less if the servant doesn't take care nicely or this or that, because they're not so interested in being served. But they know that for that person it's bad, because it's not, so then he may be chastised, you know, because they won't develop the proper attitude of service towards Krishna. Like this. So it's he doesn't eat, there's no sin. It means we're eating sin because we're doing it for ourselves, it's not connected to Krishna. Means we cook something for ourselves, then we think we are doing the cooking. It's actually the modes of nature. We've desired to do the cooking. Krishna sanctioned it, and the modes of nature have arranged that the body and mind and senses work together along with the material elements, and we cook something. And because the mind is attached to certain aspects of the material elements, then when we eat it, those sensations on the tongue, then the mind will call that enjoyable. Right? Because it's completely, how do you say, arbitrary. Means what one person will say is wonderful, someone else will say is terrible. You know? I've seen where sometimes we have the boys and we're out traveling. So when you're traveling, you get all kinds of things, you know? And you get something, and like you get some, or someplace you get some South Indian food, like an idli. All the boys are eating that. One boy won't touch it. Like to him, it's terrible. Idlis are just terrible, because they've been, you grind the rice, leave it overnight, so it ferments. So then in the morning when you mix it with the dal and steam it, it fluffs up, becomes fluffy. So to him, that slight fermented flavor to him is like really terrible. I mean, the faces he makes, this and that. Others, they're very happy. For them it's a nice change. So it's arbitrary according to what the mind is attached to or not. Because it's not the element. You know, we may say, well, something is bad. But I mean, there's living entities that have tongues that like things that we would call terrible. You know? Like that. You know, I mean, you have garbage, there's animals, crows love that, you know. Like that. Do you put up a Hindi cinema poster on the wall, and you know, some days later you see a cow or a goat, you know, eating it, you know, because it's got, they stick it on the wall with some, you know, generally some atta or something, mix atta with water and stick it on there. So they come along and eat the atta, okay, the paper comes along with it, extra flavor, you know. So we put that to it. So because we think, I am cooking this and I'm doing it for myself, the result's mine, therefore, having done it for yourself, it's against the rules, because things are supposed to be cooked according to the rules of sacrifice. It's supposed to be offered in sacrifice, whoever it may be. The actual position is to offer it to Krishna. But at least some demigod, you know, something, at least you have to recognize there's a source of this. You know, the minimum is at least the material energy that you recognize as a higher form, and therefore this has come from there, and so the material energy is maintaining us. You know, like this. Otherwise, then it's sin, because we're not following any form of sacrifice, right? And we're doing it for ourselves, and not according to any rules and regulations and this and that. So then that we get. But when we cook for Krishna, even if our consciousness is not that good, just that we're following the thing to cook for Krishna, we've taken that step to follow the process of sacrifice. So that much he is accepting. Therefore, someone with low consciousness, it doesn't taste as good. It means as long as there was some consciousness, you know, of wanting to cook it for Krishna. You know, if somebody just, you know, they had to cook and they didn't want to cook and this and that, they don't pay attention, that's another thing. Then there's nothing there for Krishna to eat. But if it's a matter of that there's something, then it'll be nice. But then some with more consciousness, it'll be more nice. Like that. So the more advanced, the more consciousness there, the more there is for Krishna to eat. So then Krishna becomes more satisfied. So then we become more satisfied. So that's the taste. I think Prabhupada mentions it also. It's Krishna's saliva. And Lord Chaitanya in that, what is it? Eshak Akshur Dilo? No. No, Esha, Krishna Ashwadila. I don't remember. It's the second Prashad Seva prayer.
Are you saying then if we cook at home but without the consciousness of really cooking for Krishna, but still we offer it, Krishna might even not accept it?
As long as we're following the rules nicely, means we're being clean, we're being conscious of properly doing things, then he'll accept it, though there may not be much consciousness there, but there was some consciousness that we're cooking for Krishna, we're going to offer it for Krishna, like that. So that's there. That we shouldn't worry about that. It's not that we don't know if Krishna will accept it or not. We know if we follow the rules in that, then Krishna says he'll accept. But then the problem is just what is our consciousness? Generally, in the case of cooking in the home and that, then we're dealing with another aspect. It's not a matter of, it's a matter of we're cooking what we like to eat, we offer to Krishna. It means we have certain things we like, so because we like it, it's good. And we want to offer what's good to Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? So then Krishna accepts that, because this is what we consider is the best. So Krishna accepts that. But it's not a highest platform as, well, what does Krishna want to eat? Because Krishna has his tastes. You understand? It's just like, how you say? Yeah, someone gives you something because they like it. You may not specifically like it. I mean, it's okay, but you're not like overly excited about it. And because of their, you know, friendship or that, when they offer it, then it's accepted, it's taken, and it's nice. So what you're enjoying is the atmosphere of them in that relationship giving it to us. You're not necessarily enjoying what's cooked. You understand? It's the atmosphere that's there, the exchange. But then more is then if that person invites you, knows that you like certain things, and then very carefully makes those for you, then the atmosphere becomes heightened even more. Is that understood? So that is the one thing that generally we worry about when we're doing our own, is that we're not just doing what we for ourselves like that, because that's called aropya siddhi, is that you take some activity and then you transpose on that, you know, our likings and all that, and then engage that in Krishna's service. Like that. So but if we don't care for the rules, we don't wash our hands, we eat, you know, eating while we're cooking, or we mix prasad with bhog and things like that, then Krishna may not eat it. Because those are just how he'll eat it. He can't eat things are mixed or unclean or this or that. Right? It means that someone who doesn't know, right? Let us say you meet somebody, they're interested in Krishna consciousness. You teach them that they should offer vegetarian foodstuffs. They don't know all the rules, this and that. So to them, they just want to do nice, and they cook vegetarian, and they do this, and they put it on a plate, and they do all these different things. And it's simple, but they do that. And Krishna accepts that part, because they don't know. Right? They don't know. Therefore, we see the Kim Purushas, and that they're saying... we offer our prayers and do things for the Lord, but he accepts even though we're quite not very sophisticated or cultured, because they're all, you know, like forest people, and they all like are half men, half animals, and like this. So their language is a little rough, their dealings are a little rough, but they're saying the Lord is so kind, he accepts. Like that. Does that make any sense? Like that. But if you know and you don't follow, then there's a problem. Then there's a problem. Therefore, the Shastras say, don't read too much, because what you read and you know, then you need to follow. That's why it said it's dangerous to read too many books. Because if you don't understand the principle and can relate it to what you're doing and it fits in nicely, then you know. Then you're held responsible. Yes. There's the element that, since it's in the Dham, it's the Lord Himself is already running it more directly. Outside the Dham, then through the energies of the external energy, things are going on specifically. But in the Dham, that external potency is manifest as Yogamaya. And He Himself is more in control. So if we receive anything, it's understood that it's His mercy that we've received it. So in this way, it's called prasad. Prasad means it's mercy, like that. But it doesn't mean that we can just avoid all the process of offering and this and that. It means it's one thing if we're just sitting, you know, in some dilapidated place or like that, don't care much like that, and whatever just comes along, we accept that and we eat that, or we go out and beg from a few people and bring that back and just eat that, and then chant and read and associate. And that's one thing. Then we can just call whatever comes, that's all the Lord's mercy. You know, but if we have a nice house, we make very, you know, nice arrangements for our food, we have a nice kitchen, you know, we get this and that from various places where we bring in good things and all that, and then we go to all the endeavor, we cook all the things, then we say, yes, it's the Lord's mercy, and don't bother with offerings, this or that. That's not fully honest. I mean, it doesn't match. Because we're not necessarily seeing it as Krishna's mercy. Because, like, we'll just have made all this arrangement and all this, and then we get it all together, and we've made something really special, and we brought from here and there, and like that, and it's just the right amount, and then suddenly somebody knocks on the door and comes in, and then, you know, you can see the look on their face or this or that, that, you know, it wasn't the right time for the person to come. You know, either it's the wrong people or they'll have to share, or, you know, so many things may be there. So it doesn't balance. Because they're seeing one side as the Lord's mercy, but they're not seeing everything as the Lord's mercy. You know, therefore, when we get harassed by somebody, we see that the Lord's mercy, you know, something, you know, not very pleasant happens to us, some disease or some other calamity, it's the Lord's mercy. We get chastised by others, that's the Lord's mercy. Like this, then it all matches. But if it's like, you know, this one's making politics and that one doesn't behave properly, and who is this one to do this and that, and then anything I get to eat is the Lord's mercy, then it doesn't balance. It's the Lord's mercy that we've gotten it, but it's also the Lord's mercy that we have the opportunity to offer it to Him. Like that. That is there. Like that. See, there's visions that the advanced devotees may have, because they'll see Krishna everywhere. You know, they'll see in everything that's going on. They see Krishna's hand. So then when they get something to eat, they also see that as Krishna's hand. But if we don't see everything as Krishna's hand, and then anytime we get something to eat, and then we use this advanced technique, well, we just go down to the shop or here and just whatever we get there, because their Dambasis is prasad. But then when they, you know, say gullah gully like this and try to overcharge us and all this and that, and we get angry and this and that, then that should also be understood that's the Lord's mercy. But that's not the Lord's mercy. Nonsense Dambasis or these Bengalis or, you know, Rikshawalas or, you know, like this. So it has to match. There has to be a balance. So that's the whole point of the Pancharatrik system, is to create that balance. And the whole point of Varnashram Dharma is to create the balance. Like that. So that everybody is situated according to their position, and then they live according to that. And then it becomes nice. Otherwise it gets out of balance, and then it's a disturbance. Like that. It gets out of balance. Is that what you said? Yeah.
What is exactly what Krishna likes? Because we have very general descriptions in the Chinese and the Tibetan. As far as basic things, but
don't know, I've heard many times different devotees say that they're going to research and get all these recipes for all those things. But a lot of those things are there. I mean, shukta, shak, bhaji, and all, so many different things. We have those recipes, I think, like in Jamuna's cookbook. Out of 1,000 recipes, probably a lot of those are recipes from there. He just tends to use Hindi names, so you might have to check in the her little write-up, just where it's from or this or that. Any recipe that Prabhupada gave, Pishima gave, these are all very, you know, proper, or, you know, things she's tasted at different temples. Because she, many preparations, she gives a little history of it. So you could just go through and just collect all those recipes like that. And then you get very much of an idea about that. You know, and you can see from that song, so many things are there. There's a lot of stuff there. You know?
What about the philosopher? It mentions certain vegetables and things, and in particular it mentions that in Norway likes eggplant.
Yeah. That's why in Bengali it's called bay gun. Gun means qualities and bay means without. So that's what it's called. It's called a vegetable that has no qualities. But if you deep fry it in fresh mustard oil, then it has at least some good taste.
Like that.
Yeah, generally it's not to be used. In more contemporary times, it's been used more. But it's generally used more sparingly. Like the, I think, neem begun, that's a respectable preparation. They'll use a very small amount, cut in little pieces, and shukta can be used. Then sometimes they'll cut it in small squares, deep fry it, and then put it into the spinach. And a couple of special preparations. There is Prabhupada gave a recipe of bhakti chachari where you could use eggplant, though the vegetable of preference is pakal, like that. But other than that, it's and then where you cut it like in rings and put some turmeric on it and deep fry it. But other than that, it's not used just as a straight vegetable very much, and that it's doesn't. Not that good because it has the chemicals in it. It has a chemical in it that is very bad for the semen in the body. It just makes it thin, so that weakens the body. So it's not considered good like that. So it's generally avoided for that reason. So if it's used a little bit with the neem, I think the neem cuts that chemical. The other preparation, I'm not sure. Maybe the shukta also, but other than that, then it's a little more risky. But it's cheap. That's why it gets used so much. You know, that and potatoes. Interesting, they're both from the same family. Yeah. Eggplant, potatoes, tomatoes, chilies. They're all from the nightshade family. You know the deadly nightshade? Like that. So they all have some of that toxin in it to some degree. Tomatoes have it in the skin and seeds, and they don't have it in the rest. Eggplant, somehow or another, has, I'm not sure where it is. It may also be skin and seeds, because that you generally don't get rid of the skin and seeds when you cook it. Potatoes, if they're green, then they manifest that. Like that. Chilies also have chilies, and then the big ones, the bell peppers, capsicums, they also have that chemical. So it creates, too much of it can create lust. You know, because it just, the semen drops, so it creates lust. So you find it's very popular in, especially in how you say, Latin cultures. You know, because they're very passionate people. So, you know, tomatoes, eggplant, eggplant, you know, some little chili. You put that all together, it's a very popular combination. So.
And I read that I was very interested because of American omnis saying that dog plant, pussy plant, eggplant.
Yes, so he is one of those people that Krishna doesn't go near.
Yeah.
It also mentions safflower. Uh-huh. Safflower is not at all appreciated by the Lord, and especially those who eat it. Sunflower is okay, but not safflower, even though it's the highest in polyunsaturated fats and all that. But it, when you eat it and you digest, I guess it's slow at digesting or something. If you burp, that particular smell is very annoying to the Lord. Like that. And mula, generally it's also not so much recommended to be eaten, but we see Lord Chaitanya would eat it. But it's mainly recommended that you wouldn't eat a bunch of mula and all that, and then a short time later go into the deity room. You know, because it creates some gas. Like that. Main thing is mula creates gas. It helps digest other things, but it itself doesn't digest so well. Like that. The main thing is the main element of Havishan, like you have Havishan, which means that which we offer. The main element, the simplest definition is anything that's pure vegetarian. Like that. That is what can be, that's the scope of field to be offered, except for those things that specifically have been told don't use, like red lentils, like that. Or
the white eggplant.
Yeah, white eggplant. White eggplant's like a real no-no. The black one's not so much of a problem. It's not recommended, but the white one is just like, that's considered like non-vegetarian. It must, I'm not sure what, it must contain so much of those chemicals in it. Like that.
I have it in Mauritius, and it's really like...
Is it pure white?
Hot, you know, it's white outside. But when you eat it, it's like really spicy, you know, like it's a red pepper or something.
Really?
So you can imagine it.
Because I haven't. But that's not like in India, you get the light green ones. It's not that.
No, and they said to me it was actually a Japanese eggplant, white eggplant, small like this. White.
Well, most likely because the Shastras didn't recommend it, that nobody used it, and that it just when... Those who left and all that, they may have taken it with them and it got established. Because so many of the vegetables, the Shastra talks about it even though they're not here. Like I haven't seen in India a pure white eggplant, but the Shastra talks about it. Shastra talks about roses, but it'll say that they're just introduced now, you know. And then this, like this, you were telling me about the corn.
From Assam.
Yeah, from that it's growing in South America and that, and you know. It seems that it's left like 2,000 years ago. It went that side.
And even things like swans. I mean, if you look in the book, I think they rate it as winter migrants or something. But they don't come to most of India. But obviously, in previous times, they all these things.
Well, they had other swans too. And they had these swans. These swans that fly from planet to planet, like the Cheyenne eagles. So those ones, they speak Sanskrit, and they're quite big. They're not small ones. You know, the ones on the lamps, these are those ones.
The Rajahams.
Yeah. Like that. No, that's lotus stems. They eat lotus stems. As it mentions that the swan likes to... tangle its neck in the lotus stems. It has some fun putting it through there, getting down and getting the roots and the stems and eating them. So this is just stylized lotus stem. But that's what they're eating. They're eating lotus stems. You know? These guys do. They also, for the talc, you know, like birds make their own talc for their feathers. Their one is gold dust. Yeah, those ones, not the ones we see here. You know, they're not seen so often, but they're there. like that. I think in the story of Nala, then some of those swans come and they deliver the message from Nala to Damayanti, and you know, it's a whole scene like that. It means normally they wouldn't, what do you call it? You know, they don't hang around with the humans. Not at all. You know, the birds, they do their own thing. Then Nala, because he was the most beautiful living entity in the material world. Like that. Material living entity. It means Krishna is more beautiful, all the eternal associates. But of the material living entities, he was the most beautiful. That means more than the Gandharvas or anybody, Apsaras, anything. He was the most beautiful. And Damayanti was the most beautiful female. So he was actually even more beautiful than her. It means attractive. So he went out into his garden one day, and these swans were there, because he was so beautiful, these swans were just staring at him. So, you know, he was intrigued, because they were so entranced just looking at him. Then he came up and he grabbed one of them, you know, the leader of them. So then they woke up and then, you know, tried to get away. So he says, I'll let you go, you know, but, you know, you have to do one thing for me. You have to go and tell Damayanti, you know, send some message like that. So, you know, they were speaking in Sanskrit. Like that. Like you see Hanuman and those, they're speaking in Sanskrit. Like that. So it's just they're very evolved living entities, but they still are not fully human. Yes.
I was reading a text, I forget who it was by, and it was suggesting that when we hear about different things, different vegetables and things like that, the translation may not exactly align with what we understand by what it means, isn't it? Like, for example, eggplant, we may have our idea it's a black one, maybe it's talking about the green one or the white one, or, and things like that.
Maybe, but maybe not, because Sanskrit can be pretty specific. It can be specific or it can be vague, depending upon what they want. But that may be an element, but at the same time as, you know, because then in that case, then sada would mean the green ones. Green ones would be sada. Anything light is called white, and anything dark is called black. You know, like an eggplant's purple, it's not black. You know, but that would be called black, you know, or you might call it blue. You know, because many times is that the Sanskrit word doesn't have a good English translation.
Yeah, that's the point.
You know, that's there. But it's not because of the lack of exactness in Sanskrit, it's lack of exactness in English. But generally, you know, some of these things, you know, they're quite... Ayurveda talks about so many of them. Because previously the whole world is under, it's not just India, now we think of just India. But before, it's like sandalwood came from the, you know, what do you call it?
Malaya Hill.
Yeah, so they came, that's from Malaysia. So we get that from there. You know, it's like your best wood for carving and all that was teak wood that came from Burma. So different places, you know, so that's what made it special, because in those days you didn't have so much transport. So to get something like that meant a lot of endeavor. Like Madhavendra Puri, then he needed to get sandalwood, so he went from Vrindavan down to Puri, because Puri being a port, then that would be where the sandalwood would come in from Malaysia. You know, so then you had to go to so much endeavor to do these things. So it's also, that could be one aspect is the translation, but the other aspect is before the whole world was under India. And people have been taking these things here and there, so people may forget about them now. Just like one would say, well, how could it be lost? It's just like now, you go to the market, you mostly see foreign vegetables. You know, you see cauliflowers, potatoes, cabbages, tomatoes, egg, you know, all these different things. Because those vegetables have one thing in common. You can pick them, you know, eons before selling it, put them in a truck, transfer them all the way across the country, you know, stick him in a cold, you know, you can, you know, put him in a freezer and then stick him out on the market and people will still buy him. Well, the actual, you know, very settling vegetables, you pick them and you have 1 day, 2 days, and then so they don't have the same market keeping as before. While before everything was very small, within a few villages, or you just grow it yourself. You know, vegetables wasn't something you went and bought. That would be something from the city. So the villages just around would supply the things. But now they can bring, you know, from all over. You know. So then they pick them. I've seen them transfer like mangoes. It'll be sold as ripe mangoes, but they're completely green. The truck's just full. There's no, I say, packing or anything. They're just chucked into the truck. They just drive down the road. You know, you see them, and then they'll get to some faraway city. You know, it's like Himsagar, these, that, they come from like UP and things. Or no, that's Gulabkas, I think. Comes from over there. They'll truck it down here. And then they'll put it in the go down, and then they'll get their carbide gas out, and then they'll gas them and make them ripe, and then they'll put them out on the market. You know, but these are what we see in the market is like four or five mangoes. We went up to Mashudabad once, and then we were there at the Nawab's place there. It was the palace where, was it Shamananda? He got the Didi. There were three stones. He got from the wall, like that, and he carved three sets of deities from there. And so then he came to the king and said, I want this stone. You know, and it was, you know, it would not have been an easy stone to get out. And, you know, so the king was intrigued. He said, he'll make deities out of them, this and that. So, you know, it's like, there was something like Shamananda was saying, he wanted that, and then the king was saying, okay, you can have him if you can make him float or something like that. And he says, no problem, you take him out, stick him in the water. Then he floated them down to somewhere farther down the Ganga, like that. I think the king became a devotee, you know, like that. So in that grounds, there's like 30 different mangoes. There's a mango there that the guy was telling us, you have to take cloth. I forget how many layers he said you have to take fine cloth and fold it many, 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 many times. Then those mangoes can be put on those cloths. And every half hour you have to turn them, otherwise they'll bruise. So such a fine mango, you know, but you can only keep it in your own place, and it can only be dealt, you know, you can't do that yourself. So that means the aristocratic people that would have servants that would have nothing better to do but then to turn the mangoes until lunch, you know, or till the evening meal or whatever it is, like that. So they would be picked ripe off the tree and then kept like that, and then, you know, after some hours then served like this. So these things, some of the things are so fine, like the banana flowers. Banana flower, it dries up very quickly. Spinach, so many, there's like 20 varieties, 25 varieties of spinach. They dry up. They're not big marketable items. Like that. Like it looks like a four-leaf clover, Shushuni shag. Very, very good, very special shag. Like that. Then, it reduces lust. So it's used by brahmacharis and used by mothers who are feeding their babies. Like that. So it's very special spin, but you have to go out and pick it wild in the fields, you know. So some old, you know, burimas will collect it, sell a little bit of it. You know, they might get a half kilo or 1 kilo. And, you know, that's all you see in the market. So they're not a great value. Tor, the heart of the banana tree. You have to keep it horizontal. If you keep it vertical, all the juice runs out and it gets hard. So it's not a great item that you can take to the market and do so many things with. So you understand? So like that, then things would disappear. But it doesn't mean that someone else wouldn't be impressed and take it away with them. You know, or figure that out here. They have banana trees in their place. Like, I think there's very few places that eat the flower or the core of the banana tree. So then, you know, if someone finds that out, they may do it in their place, and it may fall into no one follows it here. Yes.
Talk about people taking it away. The Americans have just patented now again the jamun fruit and Karela.
And Karela patented it. It's like, it's exactly. Like, there's more people in India eating it than Americans, and they've patented it.
So they discovered it. They've actually got the patent now. It's amazing.
Wow. So that means then we could patent, you know, like Bill Clinton. I don't think anyone has a patent on him, right?
Some dubious characters, maybe.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, and then he can't become the president unless they pay big royalties or something, you know, because he's our patent. That's interesting. What if somebody walks into Harvard and discovers it and then goes and patents it? You know, would America allow that? No.
I doubt it.
You know, so they can walk in here and walk away with Karela, and then they can
patent it. And people have been writing about it for thousands of years.
Yeah, that's so funny.
It's anti, I think, diabetic use, lowering the blood sugar.
Yeah.
So they've got both. So I know with the jamun also they use the kernel, the seed, and express some oil from that. And
that's very powerful. It's amazing, huh? Yeah, it is. Nothing better to do. Yes, it's very, very strange. Oh well. So you have that, but the basic thing is that any Ayurvedic doctor will tell you that you know, the eggplants and the tomatoes and these things are not the best thing. One Ayurvedic doctor in Bombay, he said, 300 to 400 people come to see him every day. He's quite famous. And he was standing there with one devotee, and the place is packed waiting to get in to see him. And he told the devotee, he says, if all these people just stopped eating tomatoes, he says, no one would come, there would be very few who would come to see me. He just said, just by stopping eating tomatoes, then so much of their troubles would go away. Because you know, all these, like, a lot of air diseases and joints and different things like this that adds to that. Like that. Just telling. Yes.
I wonder why milk products are increasing less than they are taking in this quantity, because milk is supposed to be the mode of goodness.
Yes. So in the mode of goodness. Forget. Sviction is not here. Came across something the other day that it was giving different kinds of mentalities, psychologies of people in goodness, passion, and ignorance. And in goodness, then you have goodness, you have the side where you have the very detached, renounced, this and that. Also, goodness is that who is very much into enjoying the senses, but enjoying it in a very sattvic way. Very refined way, you know, with only pure, like you see Urvasi, you know, she that's her business is the senses, but she'll only eat ghee, she won't eat anything cooked in oil, you know, she'll only deal properly, like you can't come and stand in front of her naked, it's just too gross, you know, things have to be very subtle like this. So you have that aspect of the mode of goodness. So it's not that mode of goodness itself is the answer. Mode of goodness connected to Krishna is the answer. That's why we'll push so much, the mode of goodness is the best situation. Just like we will recommend that to chant Hare Krishna, you find a place where you can sit and concentrate and hear nicely, you know, and it will be, you know, pleasant for your chanting. But that doesn't mean that that place becomes the special place, right? It's that is favorable, that is more favorable than going out, let's say, on the highway to chant your japa. You can chant on the highway, but there'll be a lot of distractions and it may not be the best. So in this way, the mode of goodness is recommended as the best situation for performing devotional activities, because mode of goodness is also illuminating. But that illumination can be coming from nivritti or pravritti. So pravritti, you may get illumination, just like someone who follows grihastha ashram, they get illumination on what is happening in the ashram. Someone in passionate ignorance gets no illumination by being in the grihastha ashram. They just get frustrated or take the sinful activities. But someone in the mode of goodness, because they follow the duties, they do all these things, then they can discriminate between the activity and what you actually get out of it, because the mind isn't so involved. Means a person in the mode of goodness and the person in the mode of passion, they're both getting the same amount of enjoyment out of the same activity, actually what the senses experience, right? But the person in the mode of passion, he puts more onto it, right? Like say you have something nice to eat, like some sweets or something. So a person in goodness, their senses taste it, they probably even taste it better than the person in passion, because their senses are more refined. But because it's, you know, prasad and these and that, and they're regulating their life, it doesn't necessarily overwhelm them. But the person in the mode of passion, their whole thing in meditation is on getting these sweets and eating these sweets and enjoying these sweets. So even if they don't taste good, I've seen people where they get something, and because in their mind this thing is very enjoyable, but it wasn't of good quality, and they're eating, going, oh, so nice, this, that, and I'm eating and going, this is terrible, you know? I once saw it with avocado, right? A rare thing in India. There's some places where it comes. So these are like, you know, 5-day-old or 1-week-old avocados. You know, they've already gotten bitter and turned black and got all weird and all this, but the person's in ecstasy eating them because it's like they love avocados. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is not very good at all, you know? Like that, isn't it good? Isn't it good? No, yeah, like that, and I mean, it's just because their mind, they project onto it what it is, but the person in the mode of goodness, then the duties and all this, they do in a regulated fashion. They can kind of separate themselves from the activity, so they can see it in proper perspective. Then they can see, okay, the sweets are nice, but if I eat too much, I get sick. You know, or it spaces me out, or, you know, try eating a ton of sweets and then, you know, giving a class. You know, it's like the brain doesn't exist, you know, like that. So it's like this, and then you see that one shouldn't do these things. So slowly, slowly, gradually, gradually, it has that illuminating effect. Well, the other person, it doesn't. You know, it's that they'll do that and eat the sweets and then they get sick, but it's not that overeating and this and regulation. No, it's at sweets, you know, or this particular sweet, then they go for another sweet, you know, like this. Does that make sense? So therefore, milk, though it's in the mode of goodness, still you can take too much, because it is in the mode of goodness, it is nourishing, but it nourishes everything. So when the body becomes very strong, if there is sensual desire, then that will come up also strong. Just like when you chant Hare Krishna, you water the devotional tree, but you also water the weeds. So the milk will nourish the brain, it will nourish the nerves, it will nourish the body, but it will also nourish lust if it's there. Therefore, one has to be a little careful like that, especially at times if there's more lust. If you find there's more lust in the body, cut down on milk products. And then when that goes away, then you can take normal again. Does that make any sense? Therefore, you get Indra, demigods are in the mode of goodness, and all the rishis and sages on, you know, Tapasatya and Maharloka, Janaloka, they're also in the mode of goodness. But one is detached from their mode, the other ones are enjoying the senses. So both aspects are there. Yes.
I heard that one time some devotees were trying to increase their brain power by drinking a lot of milk. And so Prabhupada said that too much milk is in the mode of passion.
Yeah. When it gets too rich, anything too rich is in the mode of passion. You mentioned like halwa, that's in the mode of passion. Because it's so rich and heavy and like that. So then one has to be careful. But because it's within those things that can be offered, then it's offered. It's not that you can't, but if you just only eat halava, too much halava, it can increase passion. That's it, but that's a good point. Because of the richness of it.
So the quantity would also affect you.
Yeah, too much quantity is also, would be, I guess, would increase passion.
It's like a little bit of spice may help the digestion, but too much.
That's a good point. So you see that, Mataji? So it's like the item itself may be in goodness, but the quantity we take may make it passion. Like that, because the system can only handle so much. I know he told it to Panchadevita, this point that I was saying about reducing milk. If there's too much lust, reduce milk products. He told that to Panchadevita. He asked him in Bombay about this. So Prabhupada, this is the first thing Prabhupada said. Like that. You know, tendency those days is, you know, if the devotees ever hit a sweet shop, you know, at least 1 kilo of mishti doi, and, you know, I mean, they go, oh, they could eat 80 rasgulas. I mean, they could do some pretty far out stuff in those days, you know. It wasn't uncommon to go down to the sweet shop and pack in, you know, 20, 40, 80 rasgulas and go back for the evening kirtan and play drum, you know, like that. And you wondered how it was. They were like empowered or something. No, they're secret.
Yeah. Is there an average quantity of milk that one may take every day?
I think that depends upon the individual.
Prabhupada gave some guidelines. I can't remember what it is. He said it should be more than this, but less than that.
Yeah. Means if you are only taking milk, then you can take more. You can take kilo, kilo and a half, 2 kilos, probably I think up to 3 kilos. If you're only drinking milk and nothing else. And generally with time, after the first, I think some, I'm not sure, some months or that, then it will drop back naturally. Mm. Like that. But in the beginning, I think you use a lot more. Because the body has to completely rebuild. If you just go on a pure milk diet, the body completely rebuilds itself. Then you can take more and there's no effect. But if you're taking milk and eating, especially if you're eating grains, then there's a difficulty of an increasing lust if you take too much. But I would expect, you know, 250 grams to 500, you'll have no problem at all in a day. You know, it depends upon what work you're doing and everything. What else you're eating, how much you're eating. Yes.
Prabhupada was eating fruit and milk together, as far as I know.
Yes.
But so many Ayurvedic doctors say that this is a really bad combination.
I've never heard that. I've never heard it at all.
The other day I read an article on that doctor you were mentioning in Bombay, and he also said it.
Depends on what fruits you're taking. Mm. If it's sour fruits like any of the citrus, then it's not so good. Then that generally wouldn't be done. But other fruits, they go together.
And also because the melon fast.
Yeah, melons, they're harder to digest and all that.
On their own.
You know, like that. But the combination of milk and then after that fruit. Because the thing is Prabhupada also knew Ayurveda. You know, he was very, very expert. I mean, so the doctor that treated Prabhupada in the last, you know, month like that, then they used to have these different conversations. And what Prabhupada knew about Ayurveda, the doctor said, because he would recommend and discuss some medicines and that. And he said, unless someone was really well-versed, means your top Ayurvedic doctors, only they would know the certain things that he knows. So he was, I heard him twice tell these points on two different occasions. You know, controversial Makardvaj. That was Prabhupada's recommendation. The doctor said only someone who was like top Ayurvedic experienced doctor, who is well read in the Shastras, would even know that the particular symptoms that he had, Makar Dwaj would work for. It says most would know, they would use it in other ways. Mm. It's not uncommon like that. There are a few areas like that. Because it depends on how you're putting it together. Because most people drink milk, they don't have an order. Means basically very strict on certain things. Only Bengal has an order, really an order of eating things. South has to some degree this and that. And other parts of India and their traditions have, but they mix a lot of things. You'll see them, they eat this, they eat that, they eat so many things. But Bengal has a very strict order. One thing comes after another. If you eat it in that order, then things work. But if you mix it, like you drink some milk, then you eat the fruit, then you take some... Because that's what it means for most people. You'll probably find very few people anywhere in India other than in Bengal who will eat the fruit, and when they're finished eating the fruit, then they'll take the milk. Most will just take them together. If you say you're having milk and fruit for breakfast, guaranteed any devotee you give it to, they'll take them both together. Like that. There are some fruits that go with the milk. Mangoes go, bananas go, like that. Some you can mix very nicely. Some you can't, like pineapple and milk, that's dangerous. Mm-hmm. It actually is poison. But does that make any sense? Or?
Is there any bonafide book on Vaishnava?
Hard to say. I would just say is the things that Prabhupada's mentioned, you take those and then you expand from there. So we see that Prabhupada did it, so he must be something. And generally, between the fruits and the milk would be sweets. And that also is there. You know, that would also be there. And there's also a difference between when someone's healthy and when someone's sick. You know, when someone's sick, certain things can't be taken. When they're healthy, they can be. Anything else on this? What time is it? Huh? 6:25. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Well, ours maybe 6:35. Sometimes we can be really far ahead. Drinking Charinamrita. Charinamrita is obtained in the morning while the Lord is being washed before dressing. Scented with perfumes and flowers, the water comes gliding down through his lotus feet and is collected and mixed with yogurt. In this way, the Charinamrita not only becomes very tastefully flavored, but also has tremendous spiritual value. As described in the Padma Purana, even a person who has never been able to give in charity, who has never been able to perform a great sacrifice, who has never been able to study the Vedas, who has never been able to worship the Lord, or in other words, even one who has never done any pious activities, will become eligible to enter into the kingdom of God if he simply drinks the Charinamrita, which is kept in the temple. In the temple, it is the custom that the Charinamrita be kept in a big pot. The devotees who come to visit and offer respects to the deity take 3 drops of Charinamrita very submissively and feel themselves happy in transcendental bliss. So here is that Charinamrita is that it's what's washed the Lord's lotus feet. And then, depending upon what's there, then one can make it, you know, here, what is he? Tastefully flavored by putting some yogurt, putting some sugar, like this and that. If it's just plain, if it's been Panchamrita, then it's already sweet. But if not, then one can put that. I've seen some places, I think it was New York, they put it like in Shrikant or something. Everyone comes and, how are you saying here? Very submissively, they take 3 drops, but yeah, but it doesn't come out in anything less than, you know, like about 100, you know, about 50 gram lumps. So then everyone would line up and respectfully take their three drops. Like that. Is anything on Charinamrita?
Now, Marge, when you add yogurt, should that be from like the Madhupak or the Arya or those substances?
And generally it would be there, but it seems that you can just even just mixed yogurt, you know, just a little bit. It's not a lot. Generally you see what's done, it's very light. It would be how much would be like in the Charinamrita.
And now is there a downside? I mean, in other words, if you spill, I was reading somewhere, if you spill drops of this sacred substance on the ground, you get 7 lifetimes of Lord Brahma's worm in stool or something.
Well, that's
fairly intimidating.
Yeah, it's definitely worth considering. Yeah, well, that's why the tradition is they'll put the left hand, put a cloth on top, put the right hand on top of that, and then use a mudra that will keep the Charinamrita in the hand.
Mm.
So traditional one would be where the, how do you say, the index, middle, and ring finger at 90-degree angle to the palm, and the little finger is straight in line with the palm, and the thumb then is at the base of the index finger. So for many people, that will stop the Charinamrita. But if that doesn't, then you can use the Gokarna, which is the cow's ear, which is to take the index finger and put it behind the thumb, behind the root of the thumb, and then put the thumb then on the outside of the index finger, and then keep the middle ring and little finger at a 90-degree angle. And that will generally stop anything from getting out. So then one can do one of those two and then put it on top of the other. So if anything does spill, it goes into the cloth. Mm-hmm. It won't go onto the floor. And then you drink from the... I think the idea of the fingers at a 90-degree angle is it keeps one from getting too close to the palm. And then one takes the Charinamrita out of the Brahma Tirtha.
Mm-hmm.
That's just at the base of the root of the thumb and the palm. Where it meets at the bottom, where it meets the wrist, then because it's somehow or another the fingers hit the forehead before the nose can get into the palm of the hand. You know, it's this, these two are also used for Achman. It's the same mudra because Achman you're not supposed to sip out of the palm middle of the hand. It's sipped at the base, so that definitely makes it difficult to sip it otherwise.
Mm.
Any questions? No? Okay. Yeah, okay, so we'll end here, because the next is a long... Oh, yeah, we should be able to finish the chapter. Next time. Chapter 10, Techniques of Hearing and Remembering. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah, the wall in Bombay is quite fanatic. Can't eat anything.
Yeah.
Like that. But all the things he says, if you don't eat it, you get healthy very quickly.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. But it's really hard to follow his diet. Is it? Very hard.
Yeah, I was trying to look for a really good Ayurvedic doctor.
Oh, he's a good Ayurvedic doctor.
Yeah.
Very good. But there's also a very good guy in Delhi. Triguna. He's very good.
Triguna.
And South, I generally prefer the South Indian Wallahs because they somehow or another know aspects that the North Indians don't know. Like that. Because they generally rely on other kinds of medicine. North, they generally just use powders. Like that, which are good.
Yeah.
But South, though, you get into more variety of rasayans and other kinds of things like that. This Panchakarma. Panchakarma is a South Indian thing.
Yeah, I think he started doing it now
because what it is that the whole ideas of medicines sometimes don't work if there's too much toxin in the body. So Panchakarma cleans the body first, then the medicines will have effect. So he's starting to use that and get good result. But I find the South Indians have a more intuition into the medicine than most of the North Indians.
Yeah.
unless they're really, if they're family, traditional family lines, then they're generally fairly good. But if they've, you know, gone to the colleges and learned Ayurveda,
yeah,
then they may or may not be exceptional. It'd be okay, but they may or may not be exceptional.
And this one there in Bombay?
He's quite good. A lot of devotees like his medicine. It's very powerful. Very powerful, his medicine.
Yeah.
Like that. He's good. But he gives some pretty wild diets sometimes.
Yeah, I've heard of only Mumda for a whole week. Nothing
yeah,
else.
Yeah. Well, that's not so bad if it's only a week.
Yeah.
It's 3 months. That's when it gets a little
I was a little confused how far we have to go in order to treat and heal the body, or how much can we leave
how
it
much
up
you
to
can
Krishna?
Tolerate. It's just how much you... It's like this, is that according to the reactions, you have a certain amount that has to... Like if you have 1 week of a cold, you're going to have a cold for a week.
Hmm.
Like that. Unless Krishna wants to reduce that or extend it. But otherwise, you'll have a cold for a week. Now, if after 3 days the cold gets too much, you can't do your service, you take some medicine, you get rid of the cold, you still have 4 days left. So it'll come back later. But when you can't do, it inhibits your service, then that's the time to take the medicines and correct it. If it doesn't bother your service, then you don't necessarily have to worry about it.
Isn't it up to Krishna? He can heal the body anyway.
Can, as long as you have that kind of faith and you deal in that way.
All right.
But then you have to be able to remember him in that when it's not functioning properly.
Mm. Okay.
Like that. Right. Otherwise, if we're too accustomed to the body being in good shape and then we're happy and we remember things nicely and enthusiastic, better to keep it healthy.
Mm.
You know, if we're used to being sick all the time, we couldn't care less, then you don't need to bother.
Mm.
You know, unless it gets too bad.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.